and two speeches, one assuming a veto of the second resolution by the French, another that assumed a reaffirmation of 1441. At the core of the dithering over the UN resolutions was Blair's fate. It was very much on Bush's mind. If Blair's government fell, it would be a real disaster, they all agreed. At the Pentagon press briefing the next day, March 11th, Rumsfeld indicated that the British might not participate if there was war. That is an issue that the president will be addressing in the days ahead, one would assume, Rumsfeld said. What the fuck are you doing? An official from the British embassy in Washington immediately asked Rumsfeld's office. It was insulting. The British army had 45,000 troops in the region. Rumsfeld issued a personal clarification saying he had no doubt that the British would give their full support to any attempt to disarm Iraq. At 7:15 a.m. Wednesday, March 12th, the president and Gerson huddled over two drafts, both ultimatums. The third alternative, a simple announcement of military action, had not yet been written. Bush said it was important to have that draft now as well. Card and Rice came in to see how they were doing. This needs to end, Bush said. The UN was ridiculous. Maybe the best outcome would be no second resolution, just hang the military action on Resolution 1441. At the National Security Council meeting later that morning, Doug Feith, the undersecretary for policy in the Pentagon and a Rumsfeld favorite, briefed on the post-invasion plans for dealing with the Iraqi Foreign Ministry and the military and intelligence services. On the Foreign Ministry, he said the goal was to purge the ministry of senior Ba'ath leadership and intelligence officers. Iraq's 56 embassies abroad would have to be dealt with. They should ask host governments to expel the ambassadors and suspected intelligence officers and freeze Iraqi bank accounts. Okay, the president said. Who's going to do it? Powell said he would. On the Iraqi intelligence service, Feith said it had to be completely dismantled in a way that was transparent to the Iraqis and the world. Could they preserve the Special Republican Guard? The answer was no. The Republican Guard? No. The SSO? No. When they got to the regular army, the answer was maybe. Feith outlined his plan. Downsize the armed forces, demilitarize the society. Create a depoliticized armed forces that would be subordinate to political control. The plan was to not immediately demobilize all the people and put them on the street, but use them as a reconstruction force. What they didn't plan for was the possibility that hundreds of thousands of soldiers would just go home, that the workforce to rebuild the country would melt away. Later, on Wednesday, March 12th, Blair called Bush for an update. If we don't have the votes, Bush said, pull it down, we're through. He'd had it with the resolutions. Would you try one more time? Blair asked, referring to the key votes of Mexico's Fox and Chile's Lagos. Of course, Bush said. I'd be glad to do that. When Bush called Blair back and said his talks with Fox and Lagos were not positive, he then said to Blair, it's over. At 10 a.m. Friday, March 14th, Bush announced in the Rose Garden agreement on a roadmap for peace in the Middle East. It was another concession to Blair, who had pressed him not to delay the peace plan until the Iraq issue was resolved. Shortly after noon at the White House press briefing, Ari Fleischer announced a summit with Blair and Asnar in the Azores to review this diplomacy as it's brought to its conclusion. Prince Bandar made an appointment to see the president to convey an urgent message from Crown Prince Abdullah. The delay, the UN dancing, was worse than war in the Saudis' view. When Bandar was shown into the Oval Office, Cheney, Rice, and Card were there. Card was surprised at Bandar's appearance. The ambassador's weight often fluctuated, and that day the buttons on his jacket were straining. He seemed tired, nervous, and excited. He was sweating profusely. It was quite a scene. "What's wrong with you?" the president asked Bandar. "Don't you have a razor, something to shave with?" The prince normally wore a well-trimmed beard, and now his face was an unkempt thicket. "Mr. President," Bandar said, "I promised myself I would not shave until this war starts." "Well, then, you're going to have to shave very soon." "I hope so," Bandar said. "But I think by the time this war starts, I will be like Bin Laden." He then indicated a long beard of a foot or two. Bush bristled. He did not like being taunted and did not think the allusion was funny. Bandar knew Bush hated any suggestion that he was indecisive. "I'm telling you, you are not going to wait too long," the president said. Bandar said he had heard that the war had been set to start on March 3rd, then nothing. Next, it was supposed to be March 10th, but it didn't happen then either. Now Bush was supposedly going to issue an ultimatum to Saddam. "Don't even start," the president directed. "I'm going, Bandar. Just trust me." Bandar then went to see Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld seemed nervous. His biggest fear was that Saddam would make a last-minute offer asking for just a few more days. Then the Russians and French would argue that that was reasonable. "Well, you met with the boss this morning," Rumsfeld noted. "What do you think?" "I think the temptation is there around him, Don," Bandar said. "But I think your man and my man has made up his mind." Rumsfeld said, "It wouldn't hurt if you reconfirmed that." At 7 a.m., Saturday, March 15th, Saul picked up his secure phone at his home in the Washington area. "They blew it up," the caller from CIA headquarters reported to his chief. "We're waiting for confirmation from imagery." One of the CIA teams in the north had given the Kurds explosives and provided a technical officer to train them in their use. The target was the Mosul to Baghdad rail line, a key link over 200 miles long. It had been a troop train, and there were casualties. The Kurds rubbed it in, tossing pamphlets in the area. "People rise up. Liberation is at hand." Several dozen additional attacks were launched. In Kirkuk, near the border of the Kurdish-controlled territory, some 20,000 protesters marched on the Ba'ath Party headquarters, calling for Saddam's downfall. Anti-Saddam vandalism and graffiti were all around. Basically, it was a big fuck you. But there was a lingering problem, Saul realized. Now that everything had started, God forbid the president would pull back and stop, because the CIA no longer could. The sabotage was not really designed to weaken the regime, merely to focus it inward and create the impression of an insurgence inside Iraq. On the intelligence gathering front, Saul felt they had made more substantial progress. The agency had provided some intelligence to Franks on the location of the few remaining surface-to-surface missiles and anti-aircraft positions that had been confirmed by overhead imagery. They would be struck when war commenced. There had been a good number of other penetrations. Several Iraqi engineers in the oil fields had agreed to help the CIA and were able to provide real-time reporting on any effort by Saddam to rig the wells with explosives. A rock star recruit was the head of security in the Iraqi port of Qusar. For over 3 months, the agent had provided details on the placement of mines and security forces so that U.S. Marines might be able to virtually walk in and seize the port. Senior officers in key Iraqi military units, up to 6 divisions, had agreed to stay out of the fight, surrender, and turn over all their forces. Another of the agency's Iraqi sources in the Gulf region had provided the names of Iraqi intelligence operatives in 6 countries. The CIA had tracked down the operatives and wrapped up the teams. Several double agents were provided information that the war would be Desert Storm 2 with a massive extended force buildup. Other misinformation was spread that the U.S. would attack with a 2-division thrust from Jordan into Iraq. Other covert actions included getting countries to freeze Iraqi bank accounts abroad. In one case, some $650 million was frozen. Efforts to stop the illicit procurement of alleged WMD material, as directed in the Presidential Intelligence Order of February 16, 2002, were not very successful. The idea was to take computers being shipped from abroad and secretly program them to malfunction in suspected WMD facilities. But the computers somehow wound up in the Baghdad telephone and communications system, which went down intermittently before the war. As I had been interviewing various officials and sources during the build-up to war, three separate sources said confidentially that the intelligence on weapons of mass destruction was not as conclusive as the CIA and the administration had suggested. This was troubling, particularly on what seemed to be the eve of war. I spoke with Walter Pincus, a colleague at the Washington Post, who had written extensively about the weapons inspections and intelligence in Iraq. Pincus said that he had heard precisely the same thing from a number of his sources. So I drafted a possible news story and hand-carried a copy to Pincus and the national security editor at the Post. Pincus and the national security editor both thought my draft version a little strong. I agreed. Though the sources were excellent, they were only saying the evidence was skimpy. None were asserting that weapons of mass destruction would not be found in Iraq after a war. Pincus rightly wanted to focus on the inability of the U.S. intelligence agencies to provide specific information about amounts or locations of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He wrote a story that was published Sunday, March 16th, on page A17, headlined, U.S. Lacks Specifics on Banned Arms. I was listed as having contributed to his story. In light of subsequent events, I should have pushed for a front-page story, even on the eve of war. Several of these sources, I know, did voice their reservations within their various organizations, but I have no evidence that the reservations of these particular sources reached the president. The Bush, Blair, and Asnar mini-summit would be held on the Azores, a group of Portuguese islands in the North Atlantic closer to London than Washington. The Prime Minister of Portugal, José Manuel Durão Barroso, who also supported war, served as the host. The four leaders huddled with their top aides for a closed-door session at an airbase on Terceira Island on Sunday, March 16th. Bush began by summarizing why they were there. Maybe lightning will strike, he said, and Chirac will agree with our co-sponsored resolution, but there won't be any negotiations. He made clear his position that war would start in a matter of days, not weeks. The four reviewed the long-running diplomatic efforts, which they agreed had been pretty much exhausted. There was some discussion about whether they had legal authorization to go to war. They went point by point through 1441 and concluded that the serious consequences gave them the authority for war if there was non-compliance. And surely Iraq, in their view, had not disarmed. I'm going to have to give a speech, Bush said. I'm going to have to give Saddam Hussein an ultimatum. Saddam would have 48 hours to get out of Iraq with his sons. That's what I'm going to do, okay? He wasn't consulting, he was informing. So everybody knows, he added. Blair stiffened. If another country tried to introduce a new resolution for the sole purpose of delaying us, he said, we'd have to regard that as a hostile act, diplomatically. This brought them back to the French. I'd be glad to veto something of theirs, Bush said, really glad. The diplomatic planning was over. You know, the president said, we have to keep planning for a future post-war Iraq, and we all agree on the five basic principles. Territorial integrity has to remain. We need to be ready with humanitarian aid to get it in there immediately to head off any food or displaced persons crisis. The UN would continue its oil for food program. More than half of Iraqis get their food there, and it has lots of wealth of the Iraqi people through prior sales of the oil for food program in escrow. The UN has got to be ready to step in to use that wealth to help people out. We have to build an international consensus for Iraq, a new Iraq, at peace with its neighbors, and we'll go back to the UN for another resolution after the war. The UN can help with many issues, but should not run the country. he made it clear that the coalition would be in charge. They then worked over the joint statements that would be released later that day. "Gerson, are you trying to avoid attention?" the president said to his chief speechwriter as he left the meeting. That's exactly what Gerson was trying to do. He had accompanied the president on the 4,600-mile round trip so they could work on the ultimatum speech, which was still highly secret and not yet final. "Do you have a copy of the speech?" Rice asked Gerson. He did, but it had his notes, edits, and other chicken scratches on it. "That's okay," she said. "I'll take it." She then handed it to Blair. At 5:30 p.m., Bush and the other leaders began a news conference. The coalition had designated itself the enforcement arm of the United Nations Security Council. The leaders were, in effect, issuing an ultimatum to the UN and its process at the Security Council. One reporter asked, "Aren't we going to war here?" Bush said that the decision was Saddam's. Bush said he wanted to talk about the UN's importance. "In the post-Saddam Iraq, the UN will definitely need to have a role, and that way it can begin to get its legs of responsibility back." He did not say in public what he had said in private to the other leaders, that the UN should not run the country. Gerson finally got his speech copy back from the British. They wanted the president's speech to be more conditional, with the phrase or concept, "if war comes," liberally sprinkled throughout. Gerson didn't have any problems with the suggested changes. It was the kind of mood he was in at that point. He was going through some personal turmoil about the coming conflict. As a deeply religious Christian, Gerson was conscious that it was the Lenten season, the 40-day period of penance and prayer in preparation for Easter. His son and he had given up sweets for Lent. He was fasting for 2 days, and he was praying that something would happen to avoid war. On Air Force One, Bush and Rice agreed it was now just a matter of managing the politics of the UN and not pulling the plug before Blair had his vote in Parliament. The speech recalled the past 12 years of diplomacy and laid the fault on Saddam. "Our good faith has not been returned," Bush was to say, and insist, "we wanted to resolve the issue peacefully." On the other hand, it was a war speech and it gave little ground. It raised starkly the possibility of a nuclear attack. "The Iraq regime continues to possess and conceal some of the most lethal weapons ever devised. Terrorists with nuclear weapons obtained with the help of Iraq could kill hundreds of thousands of innocent people in our country or any other." The speech also invoked 9/11. "We choose to meet that threat now where it arises, before it can appear suddenly in our skies and cities." When Gerson was finished with his corrections, he joined the president and the others, who were about 10 minutes into the Mel Gibson film Conspiracy Theory. Bush loudly summarized the plot, and during the rest of the movie made fun of it as fairly predictable. When it was over, Bush handed Gerson a few more stylistic edits on his copy. At 7:42 p.m. Eastern Time, hours later, over the Atlantic, Bush called Australian Prime Minister John Howard, the key ally who was not at the summit. Australia would contribute 2,000 troops. "We're going to wait till morning," Bush told him. Powell was going to work the phones overnight. "Colin's going to kind of take the temperature of the allies, the Arab countries at the UN, and we'll see where we are. If nothing's changed, we're going to pull down the resolution. I'm going to give a speech that night. We're just going to give Saddam the ultimatum." In Washington the next day, Monday, March 17th, in a 15-minute call, Bush and Blair coordinated efforts to make sure there was no counter-resolution. They agreed that the Russians would have to be talked to at various levels. Blair said the prospects for the upcoming vote in Parliament looked better, but it was still tough for him right now. "I think I can win," Blair said. "I'm concerned about the margin of victory. I want to win my own party strong." At 8:55 a.m., Bush met with the National Security Council. Powell reported that nothing had changed overnight. The French were not going to bend. The president told Franks that he might have to execute what was now called Op Plan 1003V within 72 hours. "I'm not giving you the go order yet, but you have to be ready," he directed. "Do all the last-minute things you need to do." The president called in Ari Fleischer. "Go out at 9:45 and say that our allies have conferred again this morning and we have withdrawn the resolution," he instructed his press secretary. There would be no vote at the UN. That morning, Bush had the first of two full teleprompter sessions to read through the entire speech. The first half went smoothly, but as he got to the action sentences, "Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours. Their refusal to do so will result in military conflict commenced at a time of our choosing," he had a kind of catch in his throat. Gerson knew that one of the reasons to practice a speech was so the president could experience the emotions of the words the first time. Then on second practice, he could drive through them, and on the third, control them. And himself. At 4:45, Bush did a second read-through of his speech in Cross Hall, the formal red-carpeted corridor on the first floor of the White House, where he would deliver it live in 3 hours. Afterward, when Gerson walked up to the podium, Bush rolled up the text and playfully slapped his speechwriter over the head with it. Bush, as is usual in such moments, was loose, even momentarily over the line. The president had promised to keep the Congress informed, and he had two meetings with the leadership scheduled for that evening. Bush greeted the Senate and House leaders in the Roosevelt Room. "We came to the conclusion that it was impossible to do because of the French," he explained, referring to the second resolution. "We all agreed it was time to move forward. We did everything we could in the UN." He described his speech, the 48-hour ultimatum. "We will remove him from power," which was the law in 1998, which some of you may have voted for, he noted, adding that Saddam might take the offer and leave. "Please say you have intelligence that says that," House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi remarked. "No," Bush said. "We have a lot of intelligence to tell you that he's in complete defiance." About 6:15 p.m., Bush expanded the meeting to include the Foreign Affairs and Intelligence Committee chairs. "The Iraqi generals are war criminals," he told them, and added a new and significant twist. "If Saddam Hussein leaves, we'll go in anyway. That way we can avoid ethnic cleansing. We'll go in a peaceful way, and there'll be a list of country after country after country, all who are solidly with us in this coalition." Going in was important to get the weapons of mass destruction and to deal with the Ba'ath Party leadership. At 6:26, Bush excused himself to prepare. Cheney and Rice stayed to answer questions. Bush held a conference call with Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge, Powell, Tenet, FBI Director Robert Mueller, Attorney General John Ashcroft, and several others to confer on what was being done about domestic terrorist threats. A decision was made to raise the national terror alert by one level to orange/high in anticipation of reciprocal attacks on the U.S. in the event of war. Back in the Roosevelt Room, Senator Warner asked if diplomacy was at an end and if anybody thought Saddam would leave. "The odds are against it," Cheney said. Senator Joseph Biden, the senior Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, wondered about the future UN role. "I think we'll be greeted as liberators," Cheney said, ducking the question. "But there are scores to be settled. It's a tough neighborhood. We'll provide security." Well before 8 p.m., Bush was in the Red Room adjacent to the Cross Hall. He was peeved. One TV network had filmed him playing in the backyard of the White House with his dogs, Barney and Spot, throwing a stick to the dogs. He had just been relaxing. The network had been running the footage much of the day. Gerson was off to the side listening to the conversation. He didn't see any damage. Walking and playing with dogs is what Americans did, but he didn't say anything. Kersten, Bush said, diffusing things. You're being too quiet. He walked over to his speechwriter. Are you nervous?
Yes, I am, said Kersten.
My fellow citizens, the president intoned at 8:01 p.m. Events in Iraq have now reached the final days of decision. As he began, Bush displayed a slight awkwardness that is not uncommon for this president. But his words and the setting amplified the moment. The nation had grown used to these evening presentations, had seemingly even grown used to him as their president. Kersten thought it was one of Bush's better into-the-camera performances. Tom Shales, the Washington Post television critic, later wrote that Bush had a funereal solemnity and an aura of mournful regret in the 15-minute speech, and not a trace of bravado. The next day, Tuesday, March 18th, was Blair's day of reckoning. His one-hour speech in Parliament that day was called one of his most effective and passionate, even by some of his leading critics. In this dilemma, no choice is perfect, no cause ideal, Blair said. But on this decision hangs the fate of many things. At 1:30 p.m., Bush called Blair to say, "Tremendous speech." I know now I've got the votes to win the resolution, Blair said, because the whip counters have been up all night working away, and the only question is the margin, but I'm confident. They talked about the need to give Russia, France, and Germany a way back into the fold. In northern Iraq came the familiar call, "Pistachio, this is Jonestown," heralding a report from a principal rock star agent. The principal agent had recruited a rock star subsource named Rokan, who ran security at Dora Farm, a complex southeast of Baghdad on the bank of the Tigris River that was used by Saddam's wife. Dora Farm had the Iraqi Special Security Organization code word Umidza, meaning slaughterhouse or house of butchery. On March 18th, Rokan reported to the principal rock star that Saddam was at the slaughterhouse. Tim asked for more detail and verification. It turned out that Rokan had a Thuraya phone and he could get geolocated on the video display at Jonestown. Rokan was indeed right at the farm where he said he was. Rokan said he had better get off the phone. One of the brothers told Rokan, "Under penalty of death, you must be on this phone every 2 hours." Tim sent a report to Saul saying there was a possibility that Saddam or his family was at Dora Farm, or might be coming. Tenet went to the White House at 4 p.m. to see the president and Rice. He had been keeping Bush updated on the rock stars and how they were getting the CIA closer to locating Saddam. Now, he said, several rock stars were reporting with increasing detail and granularity the possibility that Saddam or his family was at Dora Farm or soon would be. Bush had never paid such close attention to a debate or vote in a foreign legislature as the one going on that day in the British Parliament. "What's the vote count?" he had asked a number of times during the day. Finally, at 5:15 p.m., 10:15 p.m. London time, the Parliament voted. Blair won by 396 to 217. Bush began business on Wednesday, March 19th, at 7:40 a.m. with a 20-minute call to Blair on the secure phone. "Not only did you win, but public opinion has shifted because you're leading," Bush said, expressing his deep conviction that people and nations will follow in the slipstream, as he has previously called it, of leaders who take strong stands and define their missions. A short time later, as Bush met with the National Security Council in the Situation Room, he asked, "Do you have any last comments, recommendations, or thoughts?" No one did. Then a secure video link came up with Franks and nine of his senior commanders. It is likely the first time a president was going to speak directly with all his field commanders on the eve of war. Franks, who was at Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia, kicked it off by explaining that he was going to have each commander brief the president. "Do you have everything you need?"
Bush asked the first. Can you win? Bush repeated his questions to each of the other commanders. The answers were all affirmative. The rules of engagement and command and control are in place, Frank said. The force is ready to go, Mr. President. In a little set piece that he had prepared, the president said, For the peace of the world and the benefit and freedom of the Iraqi people, I hereby give the order to execute Operation Iraqi Freedom. May God bless the troops. At this point, the war plan called specifically for 48 hours of stealth operations, and this invisible component would go to a new stage about this time, 9 a.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. in Iraq, as the first special operations teams crossed the border from Jordan into western Iraq to find and stop any Scud missiles. May God bless America, Franks replied. We're ready to go, the president said. Let's win it. He raised his hand in a salute to his commanders, and then abruptly stood and turned before the others could jump up. Tears welled up in his eyes and in the eyes of some of the others. The president moved rapidly out of the room, returning to the Oval Office with only Card, who stuck to him like Velcro. They're ready, he said to his chief of staff, and that was just execution. He went through a door in the Oval Office outdoors for a walk by himself. Bush later recalled that moment. It was emotional for me. I prayed as I walked around the circle. I prayed that our troops be safe, be protected by the Almighty, that there be minimal loss of life. He prayed for all who were going into harm's way and for the country. Going into this period, I was praying for strength to do the Lord's will. I'm surely not going to justify war based upon God, understand that. Nevertheless, in my case, I pray that I be as good a messenger of His will as possible. And then, of course, I pray for personal strength and for forgiveness. After his walk, the president made a series of secure phone calls to leaders of coalition countries, saying, in essence, We're launching. Sometime after 10:15 a.m. at CIA headquarters, Saul reviewed the latest overhead imagery of Baghdad. Lo and behold, under the palm trees at Dora Farm were 36 frickin' security vehicles. It was a huge number. It was not for one or two people. Bush met with Secretary Ridge and New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg at about 10:30 a.m. We're on the verge of war, the president said, and since New York City is a potential top target, it's important we visit. He praised the city's efforts at preparedness, but advised the mayor to focus on the main potential targets of the terrorists. Keep your eye on tunnels, bridges, and the Jewish community. At 11:30 a.m. Washington time, a second Special Forces commando team launched into Iraq, this one from Saudi Arabia. The president met with top advisors on energy matters at 1:05 p.m. in the Roosevelt Room. The questions focused on the international flow of oil. Bob McNally, an energy expert on the White House staff, reported that crude prices had already fallen from $37 a barrel to $31. Energy Secretary Spence Abraham said the Saudis would cover any loss of oil from Iraq by upping production for 30 days. Secretary of Commerce Don Evans said that about two-thirds of the Iraqi oil fields were located close together, and it was not clear from intelligence how many had been wired to explode. The president, displaying technical knowledge gained from his earlier oil business career, said that if explosives were rigged at the top of the well, the fire would be relatively easy to extinguish. But if an explosion were set off deep down in the pipes, it could take forever to put those fires out. If they blow up their oil fields, it will be more than 1 month. If they really blow them up, it will be years. Sometime after 12:30 p.m., 8:30 p.m. in Iraq, Tim received a rock star report that Rokan had actually seen Saddam, who had left the slaughterhouse about 8 hours earlier to attend meetings, but would be back to sleep at Dora along with Kusay and Uday. It was 100% sure that Saddam must be returning. Tim dispatched a report to Saul and said it was 99% certain. At 1 p.m., at least 31 teams of Special Operations Forces entered Iraq in the west and north. They're on the ground. They're in, Card said in an aside to the president. They should be, Bush replied. It was almost too quiet. He and Card were anxious to see if Al Jazeera or CNN or any news organization had picked up some movement. Meanwhile, Tenet, McLaughlin, Saul, and several other CIA operatives had raced over to the Pentagon with Tim's intelligence report and satellite photos. Rumsfeld talked with Franks, who thought Dora Farm was a good target, and the secretary asked that he make sure they were ready to attack it. About 3:15 p.m., Rumsfeld called Card. We've got some developments, and I want to come over and talk about them. Rumsfeld, McLaughlin, Tenet, Saul, and two other CIA men arrived in the Oval Office and went into the president's dining room. We've got two guys close to Saddam, Tenet said. He produced satellite photos that showed the location of the farm near Baghdad at a bend in the Tigris River. Saddam and the two boys have been here and might come back if they're still not there. The CIA was in direct communication with both sources. Bush questioned them about the sources. Who were they? How good were they? Well, Saul said, we'll never get 100% confidence, but the organization has proved reliable. A decapitation strike on the top regime leaders now appeared possible. They contemplated the impact of taking out Saddam and his sons. Who would make the decisions inside Iraq? Everyone was so used to directions from the highest level. The best-case scenario was that it might even break the regime, make war unnecessary. That was unlikely, but possible. What kind of weapons would you use? The president asked. General Myers, who had joined the group, said Tomahawk cruise missiles, and he proposed a strike package of 15 to 17. Bush was skeptical. He asked, who is in which building? Where would Saddam stay? Do the sons have kids? Where is the wife? Is Saddam with his wife? Are we sure it is not just where he put all of the kids to stay? In northern Iraq, the principal source phoned in a report cobbled together from what his two sub-sources at Dora Farm were telling him. Uday and Kusay were at the farm for sure, and Saddam was expected back at about 2:30 a.m. or 3 a.m. Iraqi time. The sources on the scene also reported details about the houses. Additionally, there was a Mansul on the compound, the report said. Mansul could be translated as place of refuge or bunker. Tim chose bunker. The report provided some details about the bunker, distances from the main houses, and its thicknesses in so many meters of concrete under so many meters of earth. Tim frantically took this and sent back to CIA headquarters a flash message summarizing the information. The president had more questions. Is it going to disrupt Tommy's plan? He asked. They had spent over a year on that plan. What would be the impact? Would it blow the whole element of surprise? The special operations forces that had gone in already were supposed to be covert. Would this expose them? Go ask Tommy, he directed Rumsfeld. General Myers eventually reached Franks. What do you think about taking a shot at this Dora Farm target? Myers asked. Franks had been watching the time-sensitive targets carefully, and he had known the night before that the CIA had been getting closer to Saddam, perhaps at Dora Farm. It was still during the 48-hour ultimatum period the president had given Saddam and his sons to leave. Franks felt pretty strongly and had counseled Rumsfeld that they not take a shot during that period. Franks considered it the higher moral ground not to take a shot at someone who might, improbable as that was, be leaving out the back door. Can you do it in 2 hours? Myers next asked. Franks said they could. The Tomahawks were ready to go. Sometime after 4 p.m., now past midnight in Iraq, the latest rock star report arrived in the Situation Room and was taken immediately to the Oval Office. Hadley asked Saul, can you show me where the bunker is? Saul wasn't sure, but they took the overhead photos and Hadley tried to draw a sketch. Powell was the only principal missing. and at about 5:15 the president told Rice, "You better call Colin." "Colin, get to the White House," she said, reaching Powell at the State Department. She was abrupt and offered no explanation. When Powell arrived in a matter of minutes, soon he was going through the pros and cons, collateral damage, failure to hit Saddam. "If we've got a chance to decapitate them, it's worth it," he finally said. Rumsfeld strongly recommended a strike, and Cheney agreed, though he seemed to be holding back. Bush filled the time with questions, at one point asking, were they really sure what they were looking at was what they thought they were looking at? "It's as good as it gets," Tenet said. "I can't give you 100% assurance, but this is as good as it gets." Bush was still worrying. "They would bring out dead women and children," he said, "and the first pictures would be of civilian casualties on a massive scale of some kind." Rumsfeld and Meyer said it probably didn't matter what they hit in the first strike, because the Iraqi propaganda machine was going to say that the United States killed a number of women and children anyway. And if necessary, the Iraqis would execute women and children and say the United States did it. That was indeed the downside. But the others, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Tenet, even Powell, seemed taken with the upside, a shortcut to victory. Myers raised a serious problem. If there was a bunker at the Dora compound, as they now suspected, the cruise missiles would not penetrate. They would need the bunker-busting 2,000-pound bombs to get that deep. Myers was sent off to talk to Franks. For a moment, the group weighed the downsides. They had promised to defend Israel, and the full defense of Israel was not ready. What were the other consequences? Suppose the Iraqis used a strike as a pretext to set the oil wells ablaze. Suppose they fired Scud missiles into Israel or Saudi Arabia. The consequences of an early attack were immense. The plan called for the air campaign to begin in 2 days. Bush went around the room and asked, "Would you do it?" "I would do it, Mr. President," Card said. It was too good a chance not to take. Rumsfeld, too, was strongly in favor. Powell thought it was a hell of a lot of very specific information that seemed not bad, though it was a little curious that the CIA sources on the other end of the satellite phones could have acquired so much. "If we've got a chance to decapitate them, it's worth it," Powell recommended again. Rice and Hadley had some more questions about the sources, but both favored an attack. Myers reached Franks on a secure phone. Could he load up a stealth fighter with a pair of EGBU-27 bombs, the bunker busters, for the attack? "Absolutely not," Franks said. "We don't have the F-117 ready to go." The F-117A Nighthawk, the stealth single-seat fighter jets, typically carried two of the bombs when fully loaded. Franks checked further. The Air Force had been following the intelligence and the night before had readied one F-117. Franks asked what the probability was of a single F-117 getting through and delivering its pair of bombs. The answer came back that the Air Force could only say there was a 50% chance of success. "Prepare two bombers," Franks ordered, figuring that would improve the chances. In Qatar, the Air Force squadron was able to load a second F-117. Franks sent word to the Oval Office that it would be possible. But he needed a final decision to go by about 7:15 p.m. in order to get the F-117s in and out of Iraqi airspace well before dawn. Another question arose. If it was approved, should the president go on television that Wednesday night and make his speech announcing the beginning of the war, a speech now scheduled for Friday? Powell raised the CNN effect. The attack would be seen instantly. The war was going to begin with this event. "If lives are in jeopardy," the president said, "I've got to go announce it." Cheney reminded him that lives were already in danger and there had been no announcement. Bush called in Karen Hughes and Dan Bartlett to the Oval Office. He told Saul to sum up the intelligence. Then the president said he was probably going to order the attack. "How do we do this?" he asked Hughes and Bartlett. "Do I go on television?" Should he inform the public before, during, or after? Should the Secretary of Defense do it? Everyone turned to Hughes. They knew how much Bush relied on her. No, you need to do it, Mr. President, she said. The American people shouldn't hear it from the press. They shouldn't hear it from somebody else. They should hear it from you, and you should tell them what and why. Cheney still had reservations. What would this mean for Israel, Turkey, Saudi Arabia? I promised people I'd let them know when the war begins, Bush said. And if lives, the war is beginning tonight, lives will be in jeopardy. I have to tell the American people that I've committed American forces to war. Cheney didn't seem happy. They have to hear it from me, Bush said. I'm doing it. This would be starting the war, he said. Let's not kid ourselves. At about 6 p.m., Card called Gerson. Is it ready? Card asked. There was only one speech left to give. In about 5 minutes I can have it ready, Gerson said. I want you to meet me outside the Oval Office at 6:30 with several copies of the speech. Gerson went down to the Oval Office and sat in one of the two chairs outside. Card soon emerged. We'll be with you soon enough, just wait, he told him. Card took the copies of the speech, leaving Gerson to cool his heels. Obviously something was up, but Gerson had no idea what. Tenet and his people were running in and out making secure calls. Inside the Oval Office, the president went around the room again, asking if all the principals agreed, almost pushing each to the wall. They did. Bush turned to Saul. Well, what do you think? Saul's head was spinning. He had never been involved in a discussion like this, let alone been asked his opinion. He was worried about the pilots of the F-117s. His intelligence was now going to put American lives directly at risk. The planes would be going in with no electronic countermeasures, no fighter escort, no advanced suppression of Iraqi air defense. I have to apologize. We have to present you with this very tough decision, Saul said to the president. I really feel sorry for you having to make it. Don't, Bush said. That's what I do. I'll make the decision. Well, sir, Saul said. Then I would say launch. The president kicked everyone out of the Oval Office but Cheney. What do you think, Dick? This is the best intelligence we've had yet on where Saddam's located, Cheney replied. If we get him, it may save a lot of lives and shorten the war. And even if we don't, we're going to rattle his cage pretty seriously and may disrupt the chain of command. That's well worth the effort in and of itself. Now he was unequivocal. I think we ought to go for it. The others came back in. Finally, at 7:12 p.m., the president said, Let's go. It was 3 minutes before Frank's deadline. Powell noted silently that things didn't really get decided until the president had met with Cheney alone. Myers went to the secure phone to inform Franks. Rice placed a quick call at 7:30 p.m. to Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli finance minister, about another matter. He said he already knew about the war and wished it would be fast and bloodless. She woke up David Manning, the British National Security Advisor. David, there's a little change in plans, and I'm sorry to say this, but I think you better wake the Prime Minister and tell him. Bush went to the residence. Card sat with him in the yellow room. Are you comfortable? The Chief of Staff asked. Are you ready to give the speech? He wanted to separate the two, the decision to go after Saddam and the speech. Yes, the President said. He was ready on both counts. How long have the F-117s been up? The president asked. When do they get there? The next report said they were in Iraqi airspace. There would be no more preliminary reports because they would be on radio silence over Iraq. Hughes, Bartlett, and Gerson went over to the residence. Unsure if the president wanted to see them or just receive the speech, they asked the usher to check. The usher soon came back and escorted them up to the treaty room, Bush's private office. Gerson thought Bush was subdued and a little pale. For the first time, he looked to Gerson a little bit burdened by all of this. The president took the speech and began to read it aloud. My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and defend the world from grave danger. He read through the 10 paragraphs and said it was fine. He had no changes. He walked them to the elevator. Quietly, as if to reassure himself, Bush said again, "The intelligence is good." Rice called Prince Bandar. "Can I see you at 7:45?" she asked. "Kandi," Bandar said. "We have to stop meeting like this. This hour, people will talk." Normally, any meeting after 6:30 p.m. was a kind of code word, meaning that Bandar would be seeing the president. He arrived in the West Wing lobby and noticed a photographer. Odd. When he was finally ushered in at 8:28 p.m., Rice stepped to her outer office to greet him. Flash. Bandar jumped, saying, "I hope he works for you." "Yes, yes, don't worry." They were about to sit down as the photographer snapped again, and when they sat, a third time. "The president has," Rice began, "asked me to tell you," Bandar interrupted, completing her sentence, "that we are going to war. Tell him the next time I see him, if the war has started, I will be shaved." Both laughed. "Tell him he will be in our prayers and hearts," Bandar said. "God help us all." Rice's phone rang at 8:29 p.m. "Yes, yes, Mr. President," she said. "No, I told him." "He's here. Yes, he is with me. I told him." "Well, he said you're in his prayers." "He said thank you," Rice reported after hanging up. "Just keep praying." "It's been a very long day," the president recalled of that day. "I get upstairs and I can't sleep, because I've got about an hour and a half now." He didn't want to speak until the bombers were off their targets. "I was trying to take a little nap." Once more he called Rice. No news. He tried to sleep or read or find something to do and couldn't, so he called Rice again. "Mr. President, we've just got a report from the person on the ground. A convoy has pulled into the complex." "Is that convoy full of kids?" Bush asked. It hit him that there was no turning back now. The bombers were going in first, followed immediately by 36 cruise missiles. They had doubled the Tomahawk attack package. The Tomahawk cruise missiles, which had been launched to the Dora Farm target more than an hour earlier, had no self-destruct mechanism, so they were going in no matter what. "No," Rice replied. "He thinks that it looks like the kind of convoy that would bring Saddam Hussein." About an hour later, the president came down to the Oval Office and did a read-through. He was wearing his game face now, Gerson was glad to see. The transformation from the burdened man was pretty amazing. After the dry run, Bush went to his study off the Oval Office. Rice, Card, Bartlett, and Fleischer gathered around the TV in Rice's office. At 9:30, reports came that air raid sirens had gone off in Baghdad. Anti-aircraft fire soon followed. "Go out," Rice told Fleischer. Fleischer was at the podium at 9:45. "The opening stages of the disarmament of the Iraqi regime have begun. The president will address the nation at 10:15. Myers reported to Hadley that the F-117s had successfully dropped their bombs, but the pilots were not yet out of hostile territory. Hadley went to the study off the Oval Office where the president was getting his makeup and relayed the report to Bush and Rice. "Let's pray for the pilots," Bush said. At 10:16, the president appeared on television, the stock flags and family photos in the background. He said the early stages of the military campaign against Saddam had begun, without offering any details. "More than 35 countries are giving crucial support," he said. "A campaign on the harsh terrain of a nation as large as California could be longer and more difficult than some predict. It was a time of grave danger and peril. Our forces will be coming home as soon as their work is done," he said. "This will not be a campaign of half measures." When he was done, he asked Rice how the speech had gone. One of the better ones, she told him. Hadley called Myers, who reported at about 11 p.m. that the pilots were out of hostile airspace and on the approach to land. Rice called the president. The pilots are out of harm's way, she said. Well, thank God for that. Before 8 a.m. local time in northern Iraq, midnight in Washington, Tim sent a report saying that the principal rock star reported that Saddam and his two sons were at Dora Farm when the bombs and missiles hit, but he did not know their status. Rokan, their source, had been killed by a cruise missile. One of Saddam's sons, it was unclear which, had come out shouting, "We've been betrayed," and shot another of the rock stars in the knee. The other son had emerged from the rubble bloody and disoriented, but it wasn't clear whether it was his blood or someone else's. Saddam had been injured, according to a rock star eyewitness, and had to be dug out of the rubble. He was blue, he was gray, he was being given oxygen. He had been put on a stretcher and loaded into the back of an ambulance, which then did not move for half an hour before departing the farm across a bridge. Around 4:30 a.m., Tenet called the Situation Room and told the duty officer, "Tell the president we got the son of a bitch." They didn't wake the president. And by the time Bush arrived at the Oval Office about 6:30 a.m. Thursday, March 20th, they weren't so sure. It looked as if Saddam might have survived. At 11 a.m., Bush called Blair. "Thank you for understanding that plans change," Bush said. "My opinion is that if the military comes with an option, and highly recommended it, then everybody adjusts to the plan, and that's what happened." Blair was in an expansive mood. He had led his reluctant nation to war,